So will the Democratic Party turn anti-Semitic?
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. This is Michael Brown. Phone lines are open right now for your Jewish-related calls, 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-348-7884. Thoroughly Jewish Thursday helps ground me in terms of knowing what day of the week it is. I had an unusual midweek trip to Orlando, so flew out Wednesday morning and returned today, Thursday morning, and was being dropped off at my home by my assistant, Dylan. And normally, we're coming back together after a weekend, and our garbage is put out on Sunday night. So if I'm not home, Nancy will put it out. And then as I'm coming home, say, Monday morning, I'll bring the garbage can. And I thought, do I have to bring the garbage? Ah, and I thought, no, it's Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. That's how I was able to get my grounding in the midst of a whirlwind travel schedule. Let this be a grounding day for you as well. Okay, a lot to cover and your Jewish-related calls. And I'll also be looking at some of your Facebook comments and some of your YouTube comments and perhaps able to interact with some of them as we go. All right, here's my question. Will the Democratic Party turn anti-Semitic? Not just a member here or there, but will the majority of the party turn anti-Semitic? Is this an outlandish thing to say? Now, let me first give a spiritual perspective and then some things happening right at this moment. I've often observed that when a denomination, a Christian denomination, shifts left and departs from biblical foundations and becomes, quote, progressive, you'll inevitably see a shift in these three areas. You'll see a shift away from the pro-life position towards the pro-abortion position. You'll see a shift away from the pro-family position to the pro-LGBT activist position. And you'll see a shift away from support for Israel and instead will become hostile to Israel. So radically pro-Palestinian, it'll become hostile to Israel. Now, I imagine the liberal denomination would say, well, we are on the side of justice and equality, and we're standing for the rights of women and the rights of Palestinians and so on, and the rights of gays and lesbians. And that's why we've adopted these positions. I would say it's because biblical authority has been cast off. And what God says is right, and what God says is best, and what God says is good, and what God says is just has been thrown off in the way of humanism, in the way of human standards to evaluate things apart from God's truth, hence the shift in this direction. I've seen it with individual believers as well. They make this shift, and you see, okay, the shoe fell on this, shoe fell on this, it's going to fall on the next as well. Well, the Democratic Party is already the radical pro-abortion party. The Democratic Party is already the radical pro-LGBT activist party. Why shouldn't it also become the radical anti-Israel party? So in recent days, as you have now a few Muslim congresswomen, you've got a couple of women that are serving in the House of Representatives. You've got others that have served here and there. So you've just got less than a handful, what, three total? Keith Ellison, not sure who else there would be. You've just got a handful in the Senate and the House. But these recent additions in the House have been especially vocal, and they have made comments that have been condemned as being anti-Semitic. And Representative Ilhan Omar has made comments, then apologized for them, and then made further comments. And it was talking about our fellow Democrats and others in the House of Representatives whose loyalties were divided between America and, quote, a foreign country. Divided between America and a foreign country. In other words, they're not standing with Israel because they believe that they should, on political grounds, that they should in terms of what's good for America, that they should in terms of Middle Eastern security, that they should in terms of standing against worldwide anti-Semitism, which has been so ugly and so diabolical, and therefore it is the right and just thing to do. No, the reason that they're siding against Israel or making comments, excuse me, the reason that these leaders are siding with Israel and therefore setting themselves up for attack by the people like Ilhan Omar, the reason for it is because Israel has them in their back pocket, because Israel owns them, because the Jews own them, because they're beholden to the Jews, either for votes or for finances or for both. So it's not an ethical decision. It's not a righteous decision. It's not a politically sound decision. Rather, it's a decision because of allegiance to a foreign country. It'd be like I'm serving over in Russia and I'm supposed to be working with the Russian embassy, but really my only goal is to help America, even if it subverts Russia. That's the accusation. And it's an accusation. Any of these are cloaked in language which is very familiar to those who have studied anti-Semitism. So there was an outcry over her most recent comments, and Nancy Pelosi spoke against them, and the House came together, the senior House leadership, and said, okay, we are going to draft a resolution condemning anti-Semitism and make this obviously a direct slap in Ilhan Omar's face. Well, many have rallied around her. Many fellow Democrats, young and old, have rallied around her. Yes, especially the incoming group, which is even more liberal than ever for the most part, but even some older members as well. And it's been quite a shock. You just assume, of course, we condemn anti-Semitism. Look at all the bad stuff Trump is doing, and look at all the racism with Trump, and look at all the Islamophobia and all the homophobia. So we'll just make a statement condemning hatred, which in the end, you do nothing. It's like when you used to ask Louis Farrakhan if he would denounce the latest act of Muslim violence, radical Islamic violence. And he would say, we denounce all violence, Islamic, Jewish, Christian. Well, he just did nothing. Picture after one of the tragic things when some, quote, pro-lifer decides to take the law into his or her hands, and they're going to shoot an abortion doctor. I mean, it's horrific that it's happened. Thankfully, it's been incredibly rare. But and it's the exact violation of being pro-life, obviously, to do that very thing. But they take the law into their own hands and they shoot the doctor. Someone comes to me for a statement. Dr. Brown, will you condemn this? What if I said, well, I condemn all violence, Christian violence, Jewish violence, Islamic violence, and the violence of the abortion doctors? I haven't done anything. What I need to do is say, because I'm pro-life, I condemn that. That was murder, period. As much as I abhor what the doctor did, it's not our right to take his life. That's murder. Because I'm pro-life, I condemn it. That's what you do. So if you have concerns about other issues, then you pass another resolution about other issues. But you outright condemn this. The fact that it hasn't happened, really indicates how strongly the Democratic Party is being divided. A recent Gallup poll, I cite it in my new article that's online now, asking, will the Democratic Party turn anti-Semitic? The latest Gallup poll indicates that if you look at the different groups, so let's say you have conservative Republicans, then more liberal Republicans, then conservative Democrats, then more liberal Democrats, right? That the ones who are the staunchest supporters of Israel are the most conservative Republicans, and the ones who are least friendly to Israel are the liberal Democrats, as expected. And let me say this plainly. It has nothing to do with justice. It has nothing to do with justice. Because as a friend of Israel, when I think Israel has done wrong, I critique Israel. As a friend of Israel, when I think Israel has not treated the Palestinians rightly, I say so. As a friend of Israel, I will call out some of the radical settlers who have gotten violent with Palestinians, and some of them have hatred of their Arab neighbors. I will call that out as wrong. I will bemoan the fact that Tel Aviv is the most gay-friendly city touted as such for years in the world. I'll grieve over those things. I'll grieve over the ultra-Orthodox and their staunch opposition to the Messianic Jewish faith. As a friend of Israel, I'll speak candidly about my differences with Israel. And yet I believe for many reasons it is right and it is righteous for us to stand with Israel as a nation, as a government, as well as believers. That doesn't mean standing against the Palestinians. If you stand with Israel, you stand for justice, and that means for a just solution for the Palestinians. And that means when I've got to call out the corrupt Palestinian leadership and the corrupt Islamic leadership, I'll do so absolutely without hesitation. But We are watching the shift in front of our eyes. Recent horrific news from Brussels. There was a parade in Belgium, and there were these two giant mannequins, whatever you want to call them, and they were made to look like Orthodox Jews, money-hungry Orthodox Jews. This is in a public parade, and then others dressed up like Nazis. Then an Icelandic band that's into BDSM, as in sexual perversion. They're also militantly anti-Israel, and they were invited by Eurovision to sing in Israel, and they were going to sing an anti-Israel song there. Friends, anti-Jewish sentiments are as high now as they were before the Holocaust, and there's no guarantee, it's not written anywhere, that America will always be a friend of Israel. That's not even written anywhere that the Church of America will always be a friend of Israel. Why should we be surprised if the Democratic Party turns anti-Semitic? I hope it doesn't happen, but the direction it's going to happen sooner rather than later. All right. Not happy to share that, but need to share that. I'm not being paranoid. I'm just telling you the truth. And if we don't stand with Israel in a righteous way, it will be to our detriment, to our harm. Not because of Israel's faithfulness, but because of God's faithfulness. Not because of Israel's goodness, but because of God's goodness. God keeps his promises. Some said, no. Dr. Brown, you are completely misreading the Bible. Because it tells us in Joshua that every promise that God made to Israel, he fulfilled, and he gave them the land. So it was already fulfilled. Friend, he promised it as a lasting possession. He promised it for 1,000 generations. He promised it as long as heaven and earth endure. Read sections like Psalm 105 and other passages. If he gave it to Israel, then took it back, and then never gave it back to them again, he didn't keep his promises, friends. And there's a reason that Jerusalem is the most controversial city on the planet. It's because of spiritual issues, ultimately. And because the Jewish Jerusalem must welcome back the Jewish Messiah, Jesus. That's why there's so much controversy over the city of Jerusalem, and over Jewish control over Jerusalem, and over Jewish faith in Jesus, Yeshua. All right. We come back, I want to tell you about a really neat new resource I contributed to. I think will be a real blessing to all of you who love our Thoroughly Jewish Thursday broadcast. I want to have a little fun with some of the most recent hate tweets that I got appropriate for Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. And your calls are welcome. Any Jewish-related question you have, 866-348-7884. That's the number to call. We'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Here we are. Yep. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, some beautiful Hebrew music from Israel. Okay, there is a brand new resource. I think it's the first of its kind, edited by Craig Evans and David Mishkin. It is a handbook on the Jewish roots of the Christian faith. A number of different scholars contributed to it. I have several articles in it. It's broken down into different parts. Chapter 1, God's plan for Israel. Chapter 2, God's plan for the nations. Chapter 3, Messianic prophecies. Chapter 4, appointed times. Chapter 5, tabernacle and temple. Chapter 6, the Jewish world of Jesus. Chapter 7, the Jewish life and identity of Jesus. Chapter 8, the Jewish teachings of Jesus. Chapter 9, the Jewish disciples. Chapter 10, the Jewish Paul. Chapter 11, the Jewish message, resurrection. Chapter 12, the parting of the ways. Chapter 13, the mending of the ways. So each of those chapters has several articles. The articles are all written by experts in the field, but we wrote them in such a way that you'll be able to understand them, that they're not filled with technical language. So if you're a scholar, you'll benefit from it, but just an interested reader, you'll benefit immensely from it. And then we give references, so further writings that can be studied in reference to these subjects. So we have a special offer of this book plus a free DVD. So Handbook on the Jewish Roots of the Christian Faith. So the book at a discounted price. I'm looking at it now. I'm not quite sure how we managed to do this. But the book at a discounted price with the free DVD, a Jewish Q&A DVD, available together exclusively at our website. So go to AskDrBrown.org to order. That's AskDrBrown, A-S-K-D-R-Brown.org to order. Order as many copies as you like. And hey, Hanukkah and Christmas are coming pretty soon, right? Well, not really, but get a few copies. They'll be a blessing to whoever or to whomever you give them. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Cheyenne in Canada. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Shalom to you.
Shalom.
There are two major questions that I have that I keep encountering people who claim. First of all, one very common thing I hear, I keep encountering people who claim that God is discriminatory because he chose the Jewish people. And I don't know how to respond to that. I was wondering what's the best answer to give to that.
Yeah, short answer is it's actually cost the Jewish people everything. It's been a very painful, difficult choice. So the first thing is it's been anything but paradise. We've suffered much being the chosen people. Secondly, it's not discriminatory. God had to choose a people through whom the Messiah would come so that the Messiah could save the world. God chose the Jewish people to save the world. So number one, it's been anything but a smooth ride. It's been very costly, very difficult, very painful. Number two, God's purpose in choosing Israel was not to do something special for Israel, but to find a people through whom the Messiah could come to save the world. If God didn't choose Israel or choose Abraham and then his descendants, there would be no people through whom the Messiah could come, a people ready to receive the message and share it with the world. So this was all about God's desire to bless the world, and it's actually been very costly to be the Jewish people. That's why probably most others would have refused the choice.
Amen. The other question I have is, what's the best argument to use to counter the Khazar theory? That's the other major one.
Yeah, so this whole idea that comes up constantly, I address it in the new edition of Our Hands Are Stained with Blood, which comes out in September. But in short, the best way to dismiss the Khazar hypothesis that today's Jews are primarily Khazars, so converts of the Khazar kingdom from about 1,200 years ago. First thing is this. Over half of Israel's Jews are Sephardic Jews. No one connects the Sephardic Jews to the Khazars. That's number one. So over half of today's Jews are Sephardic Jews, and no one in their right mind connects the Sephardic Jews to Khazars. So that demolishes that idea that the people of Israel today aren't really Jews. The second thing is, it turns out there is no major historical evidence supporting a large-scale conversion that brought in any number of dominant Jews into the fold of the people of Israel through the conversion of the Khazars. That's the second thing. The third thing is that you have DNA evidence that strongly goes against it. You'll read contrary claims here and there, but the best DNA science in the world goes against it. And you have those among Ashkenazi Jews who identify as having being priestly. Maybe their last name is Cohen or something like that. And they can be traced all the way back to the Middle East to around the time of Moses and Aaron, as you would expect if they're of true priestly descent. So the Sephardic Jews, over half of Israel's population, are certainly unrelated to the Khazars, number one. Number two, there is no historical evidence to back a large-scale conversion that then heavily populated Ashkenazi Jews. Number three, best DNA evidence is against it. Number four, Ashkenazi Jews by DNA can, those of priestly descent can trace their descent all the way back to the Middle East at the time of Aaron. And number five, there is no linguistic or archaeological data to support it. In short, it is a myth. Again, I'll be breaking that down in detail in the new edition of Our Hands Are Stained with Blood, which comes out in March. If you miss any of this, comes out in September. If you need to review it, just as soon as the broadcast is posted online, you can go back and listen to this call. Thank you, sir, for your questions. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Christina in Raleigh, North Carolina. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I had a question from my son the other day, and I did my best to answer it, but I wanted to talk to you and see how I did.
Okay.
If the Ark of the Covenant were to come to light and the temple were to be rebuilt, if they found it tomorrow, would they reinstitute animal sacrifices in the temple? And then, as a follow-up, since the Jews are not able to offer sacrifices now, someone asked the other day, and I tried to listen, but I couldn't quite get the straits of it. I didn't understand. How is it that they believe that they are saved, redeemed now, if they cannot offer sacrifice?
Right. So first thing, if the temple was rebuilt, absolutely, the Jews would begin to offer animal sacrifices the first moment they could. To them, this is a command that God's given that they've been deprived of keeping, and they would be very eager to begin to keep that and many other commandments as well. That's the first thing. Remember, a traditional Jew lives to keep the commandments. To a traditional Jew, this is a great blessing to be given these wonderful commandments, so that they feel deprived that they can't keep these others. The finding of the Ark of the Covenant is immaterial to this. The Ark of the Covenant was not found for the Second Temple. It was lost after the Babylonian exile. So we haven't had it for 2,000 years. If it is found, wonderful. But it's not needed to offer sacrifices. As far as how the Jewish people feel that they're saved, they don't think of individual salvation the same way you do. You know, are you saved or are you lost? They don't think of it in terms like that. They think of it in terms of personal obedience to God, being in God's favor. And then they think more in terms of national redemption, God redeeming the people of Israel, bringing them back to the land, turning the heart of the nation to Torah obedience. But a traditional Jew would say that blood sacrifices are important, but that they were never the primary means of receiving forgiveness. They would say the primary means was always repentance, which they still have. And then in place of sacrifices, they would say we pray, we do charitable deeds, and sometimes even suffering in our own lives can be a payment for our sin. And they would claim that there is biblical support for all of these views. Obviously, I differ with them, but that would be the claim, that repentance has always been central and they still have repentance. And in the absence of the sacrifices, there's prayer, there's charitable giving, and suffering that we endure in our own lives can be a partial payment for our sins. That would be the traditional Jewish view as to how they receive atonement. And as always, they would say that they depend on the mercy of God, just as they did when the temple was standing.
That answers a lot. Thank you so much. I understand better now.
You are very welcome, and tell your son to keep asking good questions, all right?
I will. He has a good friend who is of the Jewish faith, and so he's trying to understand how this fits together, and I'm doing what I can to help out. Thank you.
All right, Christina, stay right there. I want to send you a free book. It's called 60 Questions Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices. Rachel is going to get your contact info. Stay right there. The book is called 60 Questions Christians Ask About Jewish Beliefs and Practices. So Rachel, you can go ahead and get Christina's info. I want to send it to you as a gift for you, and then you can transfer those ideas to your son. All right. We no time to take the next call, but I want to get to your calls on the other side of the break. But the verse I was pulling up as Christina was asking her question was from Jeremiah, the third chapter. When you have multiplied, verse 16, and been fruitful in the land, this is after restoration from exile. In those days, declares the Lord, they shall no more say the ark of the covenant of the Lord. It shall not come to mind or be remembered or missed. It shall not be made again. At that time, Jerusalem shall be called the throne of the Lord, and all nations shall gather to it, to the presence of the Lord in Jerusalem, and they shall no more stubbornly follow their own evil heart. We long for that day to come to pass. Right back with your calls.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Welcome, welcome to The Line of Fire on this Thoroughly Jewish Thursday. If you have a Jewish related question for me, 866-34-TRUTH, 866-348-7884. There's never a day that goes by where I don't get all kinds of love expressed for me online. Oh, yeah, all kinds of love and warm comments condemning me and wishing my death and all kinds of things like that. Yeah, I'm being a little facetious. Oh, and a lot of gracious, encouraging comments. But the hateful ones are also encouraging because we know we're doing the right thing when we see them. One guy put it to me like this. He says, Mom or Dad always told him, you know, you throw a rock into a pack of dogs and you hear one yelp, that's the one that got hit. In other words, when people respond certain ways, you obviously hit a nerve. So I posted a link to my article asking the question if the Democratic Party will turn anti-Semitic. And I noticed that there was a tweet in response. So let's just take a look at this first tweet. This person wanted to know that Satan had his people. Satan had his people. And he says this, I thought the enemy of humanity was Satan. Doesn't he have a people all his own? John 8:44. Ooh, you have your father, the devil. Who's Jesus talking to? Jews. Revelation 2:9 and 3:9. You claim to be Jews, but you're really a synagogue of Satan. Matthew 3:7. Don't tell me Abraham's your father. Don't look to your lineage. Children of the light should stop yoking politically with children of darkness and instead should preach the gospel to the children of darkness. Well, we preach the gospel to everybody. This was Nicole and Bill tweeted this. I blocked them after. If you're going to call all Jews children of the devil and post comments like that, you'll get blocked. Okay? That's the reality. Sorry about that, but that's the reality. So, of course, we preach the gospel to everybody. So let me ask you something. Let's say in your community, you have a number of Muslim refugees who fled from the war in Syria, and they are being picked on by other people in your community. They're peace-loving people. They've escaped the war. They're trying to mend. They're very poor. And you get people harassing and picking on them. And I said, let's go over it. Let's stand with these folks and tell them, hey, you get picked on. Let us know, because that's not right. And as followers of Jesus, we want to say that's all right. No, you don't stand with children of darkness. You just preach to them. And you'd see how bogus that sounds. Of course, we share the gospel with everyone. My primary ministry in Israel is sharing the gospel, sharing the good news of Jesus with my Jewish people. But what does it say in 1 John 5:9? We are of God, little children, and the whole world lies under the power of the evil one. Everyone who does not believe in Jesus the Messiah is under the power of the evil one in one way or another. And we share the gospel with everyone. At the same time, there are many reasons to stand with Israel, and so we do it. So someone else responds to that tweet, and he makes very clear in his personal bio on Twitter that he is strongly anti-Israel. So look at what he has to say. He wants everyone to know Dr. Michael L. Brown's a wicked false teacher. Oh, yeah, 1 John 2, I mean, apostate. John 3:36, the wrath of God remains on me. And 1 Thessalonians, a typo, anyone can misspell, happens to the best of us. 1 Thessalonians 2, that tells us that the wrath of God has come on all Jewish people forever. That's how it's being interpreted. Yeah, that gets blocked too. Listen, you can attack me day and night. That's fine. But when you are now going to condemn me to hell, we're calling on people to stand with Israel in a righteous way. Yeah, that's the kind of stuff we just don't tolerate. But that hit a nerve. And there's this massive blind spot about the history of anti-Semitism, massive blind spot about how Christians, professing Christians and real Christians, have driven Jews away from the gospel with Jew hatred and persecution. Yeah, real Christians among them and many a false Christian. There's little understanding of that, little understanding of Satan's desire to wipe out the Jewish people, little understanding of how Israel is in place today simply by the faithfulness of God who keeps his promises. And people so zealous for God end up standing against him. Okay, switching subjects. I'm so glad that I got a reply from folks at True News. I called out Rick Wiles and True News for what to me are blatantly anti-Semitic and false comments. I've got no problem with someone criticizing Israel. You can be a lover of Israel and a critic of Israel at the same time. And you can be a critic of Israel without being an anti-Semite. And you can be a critic of Israel and an anti-Semite. So I don't know Rick Wiles personally, just met him briefly in Bethlehem, Beit Jala, last year. But we called out these blatantly anti-Semitic comments, said, let's have public debate over it. So they got back to me immediately, and they said, come down to Vero Beach, come on our TV show, and the coffee here is great. I've never been a coffee drinker my whole life. But anyway, I said, wonderful, let's set it up. But to be fair, I'd like Rick to come on my show. So I'll come on his show. He comes on my show. This way we're both in different settings where we can assure fairness. I mean, I would expect that they would treat me fairly, and he can expect I would treat him fairly. But to be totally fair, he comes on my show to discuss the issues. I go on his show to discuss the issues. And if they don't agree to that, then let's have a formal, moderated public debate. That's been our response. I go on his show. He comes on my show. It's going to be easier to get him on my show before I can go on his because of my travel schedule. But hopefully in the next 6-8 weeks, I could schedule to be with them. Hopefully he can schedule to be with me. If that's not acceptable, if there's a concern about fairness, even though I'd be willing to be on his show as well, then what we should have is a moderated public debate, respectful public debate, moderated. We can cross-examine each other, go back and forth, lay out our evidence in great detail. So that's my proposal in response. 866-34-TRUTH. Let us go over to Brian in New Brunswick, Canada. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Thank you for taking my call, Dr. Brown.
You're welcome.
My question actually kind of has to do with what you're just talking about, a lack of understanding, because the question is exactly about that. And bear with me, I hope I can express myself properly in asking this.
Mm-hmm.
So in my local Christian radio station, I hear them play spots for praying for the peace of Jerusalem, and people can call in and record their prayers for Jerusalem. And I do know that the Bible does talk about praying for Jerusalem. That's fine. But when I hear these radio spots and then these ministries that seem to be completely devoted to praying for Jerusalem, it just feels like there's no Christ in there. It's like it's almost like a fad to pray for Jerusalem, and that's it. Do I have a misunderstanding, or is there something that I'm not
No, it's a valid getting? Concern. It's a valid concern. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. It's glorious that there has been a shift in so many hearts, that there has been a desire to pray for Jerusalem. And mm-hmm. the best place to go for that is not so much Psalm 122, but Psalm 62, and to give God no rest until he establishes Jerusalem as the praise of all the earth. It's an incredible passage. So Psalm 122 is important as well, but Isaiah 62 is often neglected. So it's wonderful that so many hearts have turned towards Israel, to bless Israel, to pray for the peace of Jerusalem. But included in that prayer should be the ultimate prayer, that God would open the hearts and minds of the Jews in Jerusalem and around the world to receive Yeshua as the Messiah. And to leave that out is to pray with good intent, but to miss the real heart of the matter. And there will be no ultimate peace in Jerusalem until, as we say, the Prince of Peace is received. So don't react against it in a negative way. Rather say, it's wonderful to see things going in this direction. Now let's just take it one more step and take it to a place where we're actively praying for the salvation of the Jewish people. That is the ultimate goal. That is the greatest goal. And that is what will ultimately make Jerusalem the city of righteousness on the entire earth when the Jews of Jerusalem welcome the Messiah back and he establishes his kingdom on the earth, beginning in Jerusalem and establishes a 1,000-year reign of peace on the earth. So, yeah, I don't react against it, but say, okay, this is good, but it's only part way. We need to go the rest of the way. Otherwise, yeah, there's a big lack, and I'm absolutely with you on that.
Good. Well, thank you. It's I was kind of looking for that. Thank you.
All right, you are very welcome. Hey, don't forget, as we're speaking about the end times, what's today's date? Today is the 7th. 12 days. 12 days for the release of the book by Professor Craig Keener and yours truly, Not Afraid of the Antichrist, Why We Don't Believe in a Pre-Tribulation Rapture. It's written in a non-divisive spirit. It's written graciously. It's written by two biblical scholars, but in a way that everybody can understand. And we trust you'll be blessed and helped by it. And I'm scheduled to have Craig Keener as my guest on the air on Monday. Can't wait to do it. All right. 866-34-TRUTH. Let's go to Russell in Georgia. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yes, sir. I have one or two questions. They're not overtly Jewish in nature, but they are Old Testament. Is that all right?
All right. Close enough. Yeah.
Okay. the first question being, in Genesis, where it's talking about God forming man, in his image. Mm-hmm. Now, I got to thinking about this the other day, you know, God being three persons in one, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, or those two people there. And man, often you hear both spirit and soul being referenced. So there's flesh, and then I guess depending on if you quantify spirit and soul as separate things or one and the same, I'm not sure. Would that be possibly hitting on that?
No. When it speaks of the
nature?
Not body, soul, spirit. In other words, the fact that the Son took on flesh is not part of his eternal nature. So when it says that God creates us in his image and likeness, now it's possible, because all the appearances of God, he looks like us, right? In other words, he doesn't appear as an animal. He appears as what would look like a glorious human being. Some would argue that when it says image, it's actually talking about that this is the physical image of God in which we are created. Others say, no, God has no corporeal look of any kind. He's just eternal spirit, as if that means somehow invisible. But certainly, we are created in his likeness, in that we share the ability to love, to hate, to have moral values, to have a conscience. Out of all creation, out of all the earthly creation, human beings alone are created in that way and have within us the law of God written on our hearts. So that's what it means. Not that we are tripartite the same way that God is tripartite. I wouldn't look at it in that respect. All right, we'll be right back.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Hey, friend. Yeah. It is Thoroughly Jewish Thursday, 866-34-TRUTH. I have a new article up. You may have seen it yesterday or earlier today. Amazon crosses a very dangerous censorship line. What happened is that Amazon has now removed a book by British activist Tommy Robinson and co-author Peter McLaughlin called Muhammad's Quran, Explaining Why Muslims Kill in the Name of Islam. And I got the book October 2017, read parts of it. It's more of a historical analysis of the Quran, which of the sayings of Muhammad are the authoritative ones, etc., have the most sway, and do they advocate violence, etc. And Amazon's got a ton of books, far more critical of Judaism, of Christianity, of the Talmud, of the Bible, of the God of the Bible, and other stuff like that. Far more critical than this book. And those books are not banned. There is simply no justification for it. So I call Amazon out there. Look, Amazon still sells Mein Kampf. Fine, put in a statement you don't agree with it. Put in a statement you don't agree with it for 10,000 books there, or a million of the books that are there, whatever. But this is so hypocritical, so much of a double standard, and sets a dangerous precedent. 866-34-TRUTH. And we go to Andre in Louisiana, welcome to the Line of Fire.
How you doing, Dr. Brown? Good speaking with you again.
Hang on. All right. You somehow have slipped through the hands of our call screeners who are not supposed to allow anyone to call in within a few weeks of their previous call, in fairness to others. All right. We're slipping there. Team, take a look. All right. But Andre, since I am headed to Louisiana, as I told you just a few days ago, we'll take your question real quick. Go for it.
Okay. It has to do with Messianic Judaism. We know that the temple was not destroyed until some 30 years after the resurrection of the Messiah.
Yeah, 40 years.
And
right.
so those who continue in the Torah that mm-hmm. were believers, did they also continue in the animal sacrifice, in particular the sin offering? So that was a part of the temple ritual and custom. And can you also comment on Paul in Acts 21, I believe it is, where
yes, sir,
where he came in after his missionary journey to Jerusalem, and you know he was preaching strongly against keeping the law of Moses, that we were no longer of that.
Yeah, let me jump in, Andre. Number one, Paul opposed Gentiles being pressured to keep the law of Moses. Paul opposed Gentile followers of Jesus who were being told you must be circumcised and keep the law of Moses in order to be saved. Paul firmly, strongly, and rightly opposed that from the heart. However, Paul never told Jewish believers not to live as Jews. To the contrary, in 1 Corinthians 7, he said, if you were called when you were circumcised, then don't become uncircumcised. So if that's been your way of life before you were saved, you don't become a Gentile. But obviously the things are not binding on you the way that they previously were. And all traditions that get in the way of your following the Lord should be removed. And you follow in the new way of the Spirit rather than the written code, as Paul writes in Romans 7, 1 through 6. That being said, we see that Paul took a Nazarite vow in Acts, the 18th chapter. And in Acts 21, he reiterated that, no, he's not telling Jewish believers to stop following Moses or anything like that. You know, don't circumcise your children. He never said that. So what do we know? Well, the suspicion would be, the understanding would be, that Jewish believers continue to participate in the temple rites, but in a different way now. That if they participated in you know, the annual Day of Atonement sacrifice, it would be in commemorating what Yeshua had done and praying for the salvation of their people. Just like Messianic Jews today on the Day of Atonement are not seeking forgiveness of their own sins so much because we know we're forgiven, but rather praying for the forgiveness of our own people, the people of Israel. So that's how I would understand it. They would recognize that this system is fading away. They would recognize that what the Messiah has done has fulfilled the purpose of the sacrifices, but they probably participated in the temple rites with their people, but understanding it differently. And I don't think that they would go personally offer a sin offering for themselves for atonement because they would know where their atonement has come from. So if they participated, it would be looking back at what God has done and seeing these as memorials of what had taken place at the cross and sensing that this system was going to soon come to an end because it wasn't needed for national atonement anymore. Hey, thank you, sir, for the question. Hope to see you in Crowley, Louisiana, where scheduled to minister Saturday night, Sunday morning. The itinerary is on my website, askdrbrown.org. Let us go over to Teresa in High Point, North Carolina. Thanks for calling the Line of Fire.
Thanks. How you doing, Dr. Brown?
Doing well. Thank you.
Good. Hey, I just had a question about the Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
How do we know? Well, I mean, God just told the Jews to remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. How do we yep. know that that was? How do we know that Jews today are doing it right by doing it on Saturday?
Well, it's because it's been passed on without contradiction for several thousand years. In other words, no one's ever questioned that. It's been known that what the seventh day was, because obviously you could say what day is the seventh day, right? That's a fair question.
Right. Yeah, that's my
what
real
day
question.
Is the seventh day. Right. And you know, because you have the new moon and you know, each month it's going to change and things like that. Now, this is one of these things that it's always been known. In other words, when God spoke it, there was an understanding of what the days of the week were. And when he said the seventh day, it's never been disputed. No Jewish group has ever disputed it. No outside group attacking the Jews has ever disputed it. All the literature that we have steadily going back has universally recognized it. When you have something that all the different Jewish factions agree on, because you had different religious groups, right, just as you do today, you know, just like within the church, you have different denominations. You always had different Jewish groups in the ancient Jewish world and right through history. When they all agree on the same thing, when all the literature agrees on it, when even those who are hostile on the outside attacking agree on it, then there's no dispute of it. It's one of those things that's totally different than, you know, people saying today, are we supposed to keep the seventh-day Sabbath, or is, you know, did Jesus change it to Sunday? You have all these disputes about that. But what you don't have a dispute is that Saturday was the seventh day. So it's not like I can tell you cosmically, you know, and prove it by the rotation of the earth around the sun or the rotation of the moon around the earth. It's rather that it's been universally preserved and never in any group, critic, inside, outside, dissenting group, never been disputed in any major way. But thanks for asking. It's a question that we often don't bother to ask. All right, do I have time? By the way, Russell, I'm so sorry. I know you had a second question. That was not intentional. I went on to the next call. Sorry about that, sir. My apologies. That was not intentional. All right, we go to John in New York. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hey, Dr. Brown, how are you?
Doing very well. Thank you, sir.
I know the other woman answered the same question, but I think between the two phone calls, I think they kind of narrowed it down to, I had a conversation recently with this guy, Mike, and we were talking about the law and how, you know, beautiful the law is and whatnot, and, you know, holding to the certain commands that, you know, the Lord, you know, brought about, and, you know, the Levitical laws and whatnot. And he was asking me, he's like, you know, how come, you know, they're beautiful, how come we don't hold to them still, even though we're Gentile, you know, how come we don't hold to these laws? And I said, well, because, you know, just like the Judaizers and everything that you kind of addressed to the gentleman from Louisiana. And I said, yeah, they're beautiful. I mean, in all honesty, and I wish I could walk around with a tallit and a kippah, you know, but it would kind of be weird, you know. but I guess.
Yeah, so just real, I just got to jump in because I'm almost at the end of the hour. So your question.
Yeah, so basically my question is this. What did Jesus really refer to about lawlessness? I'm assuming it's the heart being run to grace.
Yeah, lawlessness just means wickedness. And anomia is just wickedness. When workers of lawlessness, that's disobedience, that's rebellion. It doesn't mean that someone is not keeping Torah ritual laws. In fact, whenever you see the Greek word anomia for wickedness / lawlessness used in the Septuagint, it's never referring to a verse about Torah specifically. In other words, the word used that it's translating is not like against the Torah or something like that. It's always just wickedness. That's what it means. It's rebellion against God. And there's a wide range of areas in which we can rebel against God. Rebelling against his ultimate moral law. And it doesn't mean not keeping specific commandments in the Torah. But thank you for the call. Hey, Courtney, just looking at your mocking comment on Facebook, all the Jewish factions agree Yeshua is not Messiah. Bad example. LOL. No, actually, Courtney, that's not true. You ever heard of me? I'm a Jewish believer. You ever heard of about several hundred thousand others of us who are Jewish believers? You ever heard of Paul, Peter, John, Matthew? Yeah. There has been nothing but dispute about Jesus being the Messiah ever since he came. There has never been a generation where there have not been Jews who said that Jesus is the Messiah. So actually, nothing to be laughing out loud about. It's a good observation on my part. But thanks. Maybe you'll catch me next time. God bless you. We'll be back taking your questions. Phone lines will be open tomorrow.